Welcome to another episode of This Is Hot Boga. That's happy that you're here.
I'm ready to get this rocking and rolling.
Before we dive into all these bow hunting subjects, I would like to spend a few minutes talking about and thanking some of the companies that make this podcast possible. So first up, Sturka Optics. We run a bunch of their glass.
Love the glass.
Everything from spotting scopes to binoculars. They have stuff entry level to, you know, very high end. And they have a fantastic warranty. So if you're going to be looking for binoculars in the near future, go to SturkaStrong.com. You'll do yourself a huge favor.
Best in the industry. Check them out. So another company that we really like is New Breed Archery. They've got fantastic products. They're really built well. They're made here in America. Kyle's really done a fantastic job assembling an awesome team. We got to talk to him a few episodes back. So
Check out that episode too. You learn a lot about the company.
Yeah, it was a great talk. Check them out.
Next up is Black Eagle Arrows. They make fantastic carbon shafts.
You have yet to break one.
No, I broke my first one the other day.
First time.
Which I've shot thousands of shots. And just from switching from compound to traditional archery, you're going to miss the target a lot. Mm-hmm. So I did. And they held up really well. Go to blackeaglearrows.com to get yourself.
If you guys don't know what ASAC Camel is, it's pretty much one of the only camel companies that doesn't use green in their camel pattern. And there's a reason for that. It's because green is really the only color for bugs, birds, and reptiles. Wear something that you're actually going to use and it's going to help you. ASAC Camel, check them out.
All right, another company that supports our podcast is Burris Optics. They make something really cool. It's called the Oracle Bow Sight. And it's a rangefinder combined with a bow sight. It instantly ranges it, adjusts your sight, and it's fantastic. It's totally worth checking out. BurrisOptics.com.
Gear definitely gives you advantage over the animals. And nothing or nobody does it better than FHF gear. Good gear really stacks the odds in your favor, and nobody does it better than FHF gear. They hold our S7s beautifully. Check them out. Fish Hunt Fight Gear.
No, that's actually a lot of our guests have called from the car in their driveway. But before like we kind of start, I want to, you know, you've got a long story. You've got a good story. But I want to make sure I honor and respect that as much as I can. So I'm going to try to give you a moment to talk about your background and everything. But just making sure that I get everything right. Just stop me if not. But want to make sure we do it well and tell your story well, too.
No problem.
All right, Sid. Well, thanks for coming on our podcast. You know, probably a lot of our listeners know who you are, but for those who don't, do you mind telling us a short, you know, maybe bio or background who you are?
My name is Sidney Smith, and I like to party.
That's right.
Classy. Yeah.
I like to party. No,
quick, I'm a Utah boy, born and raised. I have a wife and four kids right now, and I live on the eastern side of Utah, northeastern Vernal right now. I grew up in Wasatch, on the Wasatch Front, Provo. Yep. But a little bit about me. I'm 35 years old. I love to hunt, love to fish.
Love the movie Hot Rod?
Yeah, love the movie Hot Rod, yes. I do triathlons. That's probably some of the things I like to do to keep myself busy and in shape. I love to work out. I am missing both my limbs below the knee. And what else? I just like to spend time with my family. That's pretty much it in a nutshell.
So you've got a big race coming up. I think I've heard on another podcast. You're doing the Ironman. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. I am. I'm doing the Ironman, the longest distance for triathlon. This coming year, November 2nd in Florida.
How long have you been, so I'm guessing you made that decision fairly recently. How long is the training plan for that?
It's got to be a battle. Yeah. It's going to be one.
It's been a battle. The training plan specifically for this race is kind of started already as far as the workout plans I'm getting from my coach. The whole mental concept and, you know, learning how to walk and run as an individual, and then training as a triathlete, and then working myself up to each step. That started, you know, in the hospital when I lost my leg. So it just kind of has been building up to this, you know, grand point.
How many miles are you running a day right now?
Right now, where what I should be or what I am right now is totally different. But right now, I'm not running a lot. I'm putting in about a 5K, and then spacing it out with my bike and swim. So I'm probably running 5K here and there, and then building up. Part of the reason is that I got a new set of legs, and I'm just testing them out, see what areas are giving me sores before we get a final complete set that will be my go-to legs for the next 2-3 years until they break down.
How does that, what's that break-in? I can't even imagine that break-in process for, you know, for a new pair of prosthetic legs.
It takes a while. Like, as a new amputee, because your limb, when you first get it amputated, becomes, you know, inflamed, and there's a lot of muscle in there that needs to be atrophied, or just the volume of it needs to come down. But as an amputee for 3 years, there's not a lot of volume change. There is some, and so it just depends on the fit. I have a really good prosthetist. We had one. The left side was like almost perfect, pretty close though. We just need one small change. The right side, there was some changes. So that process, by the time they pour the mold and then turn it into a plastic socket and then turn it into carbon fiber, roughly it's about a month. It just depends on the doctor and what he, how he sees it in the patient on that case. But for me, it's about, you know, 3-4 weeks.
That's incredible. How long is an Ironman again? I completely forgot. But like, what are the distances? Like, what's
a marathon? Two miles, right?
No, it's got to be way more.
Two miles of swimming.
Yeah, it's 2.4 miles of swimming, and that's the first part of the race. And then the second part is the bike, which is 112. And then the last part is a marathon and the run, which is 26.2.
Okay.
Hey, I've done a sprint triathlon.
Have you really?
I did, yeah, and I won it.
Did you really? The
mountain bike division.
I think we talked about this once.
Nice.
Yeah, not to toot my own horn.
In high school, Jared was a big swimmer, so I've seen him run, and it's not great.
It's not the prettiest.
But he can swim like a fish.
If I stood straight up and down, you could probably fit a beach ball in between my shins.
Yeah, he looks like he's been riding a horse for quite a while.
Got a couple
but those are good flipper legs.
Yeah, it's not pretty, but.
So what possessed you to decide to run an Ironman or just to get into triathlons at all? Like, you know, a lot of athletes out there are good athletic guys in good shape, and there's no way that they're even attempting, you know, such a physically demanding race. And you've got prosthetic legs and you're deciding to go and do something that most people, you know, aren't able or aren't willing to do. What made you decide to do that?
You know, some people have told me that when I lost my legs that the doctors did something to my brain too, cause I'm crazy. cause I wouldn't have, you know, really thought about that before, but it started really in the hospital, just the idea of it and the desire, the beginning desire. Yeah. When I lost, when I became a double amputee in November of 2015.
Okay.
They had a lot of downtime, and on TV they had the Ironman race world championship course in Florida, in Hawaii, and it was just awesome. And I've never seen it before. It's just, if you ever watch it, NBC does it, and it's just they just make it real pretty, and the success stories of people overcoming cancer and so forth. It's just really inspiring and motivating. And me, you know, thought, oh, how awesome would that be? But at the same time, my mind was telling me, you know, how is that even going to be possible if you don't have the legs? And so I was happy and sad at the same time. And it wasn't until they did some B-roll and I saw someone running with a prosthetic, and I thought, oh my gosh. And I never knew of another prosthetic or someone with a prosthetic, because I live in a small town and I didn't even know that that was completely possible. And so I did some research while I was there and found out that it was, and I just completely moved by, you know, the hard work and what it could take. And so I just made a deal with me and God that, if this was a possibility for me to get out of this room and walk and run, then I would do that, you know. And as I started training, I realized how hard it really was. But yet I kind of stuck with it, and I hit different milestones. Like when I hit my first 5K, I did my first sprint triathlon like 5 months after. And so as I started realizing that I have the capability of doing it, and then, you know, the opportunity that I can run and do things. I just didn't want to take that for granted. It was almost like, kind of like a second life, or just like I just had an opportunity to do things that I never wanted to do. And then I was given, I almost felt like a blessing or a gift that I was given, that if I had this second chance, I feel like it would have been disrespectful to my maker to not take advantage of it. Mm-hmm. So I had to, and I'm glad I'm sticking with it. So.
Well, you're inspiring a lot of people along the way, which is pretty incredible. I mean, you've got the documentary that we saw, I think, with Mountain Ops. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, some of the stuff you've been with Grady Bowman, and there's the Backcountry podcast, too. At least those are the ones I listen to.
Yep.
Your story is amazing.
Thanks, John.
The whole time I'm thinking, I've heard you talk about, the dark times that you've kind of gone through as, you've made the decision to get your legs amputated, and how difficult that was. That whole time, what was kind of your source of strength, or what kept you going? What inspired you to just make it through during that time?
Well, it wasn't easy. It wasn't something that was a light bulb that clicked, or a drive that just automatically was generated inside. I admit it was a dark time where I battled, whether to move on or end my life. And so it wasn't something that I feel was inside of me, or was something I was born with, that I can just have that capability of just saying, hey, this is a trial, you're going to overcome it. It was kind of a long battle with my soul looking at an outward perspective of life differently, till for me to realize that there's a lot to life worth living, and what are the most important things? How can I find what matters in life? And what kept bringing me back was my family. And I'm supposed to be this individual that's supporting my family, and they rely on me. And for me to not be there for them, or do something selfish as, suicide, would be horrible, and what that would do to my kids. And so, that thought was, although it was entertained, was quickly turned into a motivator to get through it and try to live a life of joy, and try to lead an example to my kids. Really, that even though we've been given, each of us have our own struggles and trials that we've been given, that there's ways, there are purposes to overcome them. So.
No, it's cool. And you can use those to do great things and give people some great strength and hope to watch somebody like you do what you've been doing, especially, for people that are interested in hunting. That's kind of how we found out about you. How long have you been into hunting?
Oh, since day one, as long as I can remember, really. It was a family tradition to go to deer camp. I mean, it started with my dad, and then I was the oldest in my family, so my brothers came later, but we all got into it, and then his dad did it.
Yeah.
His dad did it, and it went back generations. It was awesome to look back at photos of some of the deer that they killed, back in the 50s, and it was insane. It's always been that way. I've always loved hunting. It wasn't really until I lost my legs and became a double amputee that I take it to the next level, such as, doing it, more often, hunting with my bow.
Yeah.
And almost changed it from something we do in the fall to a whole lifestyle and what I focus on all year long.
Yeah. Where'd you grow up? Where's your family from?
I'm from Provo itself, but my dad's side, where we did our huntings, in southern Utah, in a little town called Circleville.
Okay. So a lot of mule deer hunting.
A lot of mule deer hunting. Yeah. I don't think I even saw elk until I was teenager.
No, I've actually, I've gone to Colorado hunting 2 years in a row. I still haven't seen an elk, so I feel your pain.
Nice. They're there.
So, yeah, that's right. I mean, it's a lot of walking, a lot of looking. You see a lot of other things, but
it's just motivation every morning to wake up. They got to be here.
They're going to be. I just, at some point, you got enough. What's even a blind squirrel finds a nut. That's my mentality when it comes to hunting. Just kind of wander around aimlessly, hoping to get really lucky. Mm.
It always depends on what you have in your pocket. If you have a deer tag, you'll see elk.
That's right. This fall I was debating to get whether or not I should get a black bear tag. I'm like, no, you know, it's kind of expensive to do this. I'm just gonna do an elk tag out there. And I had a big old black bear. I mean, just right in range.
Smelled that candy.
And he knew. He's like, he doesn't have a tag in his pocket. I'm gonna follow him around. He's safe. So, how do you? So you made it sound like you've. This is kind of a year round kind of passion for you. Hunting is. What does that look like? What kind of preparation are you doing to get ready?
Well, I mean, triathlons is probably where I get a lot of my physical training. I do like to lift weights. I'm a believer in getting in the hills, and I mean, not necessarily, not just knowing the country and areas you can access land and finding that animal, but I think being physically in shape is a good advantage. Yeah. Because it also, you know, just being in shape, it helps you be more mentally there, because if you know you're out of shape and you're tired, you're not going to be mentally there as well as physically there. I use that to kind of prep me for that. But I just it's almost like a 365 thing where, you know, right now I have even though it's January, I still have a late season cow tag. And then, you know, February you have a lot of the shows and then just kind of getting ready for shed hunting. And I use shed hunting too to try to, you know, get into areas that I've not seen to explore, and then set up trail cameras and salt licks and apples and so forth in certain areas that I like to sit, and then use camping, you know, with my family to get up on the mountains. I mean, where I hunt most of the time is just right here in my backyard in New England, so I get to know that country pretty well.
Yeah.
And then you know, I really like to do the homework come June, July on mule deer to see their areas where they've been, where they like to go to find that certain buck. And then, you know, it's come archery season is probably where I like to cash in the most, but sometimes I like the muzzleloader rifle.
Oh yeah. So you got a late season cow tag. When does that season end?
January 31st.
Oh man. That's a whole month.
I know it is. And you think it, you know, where I hunt, it just depends on the weather, whether they'll come off the top to come down lower.
Yeah.
But it's a battle, because my other passion I have too many. My wife will tell you that 100 times, but I like to ice fish. And so ice fishing, really? And late season hunting or hunt for coyotes or something like that. Sometimes it's a battle, because I'll be like, oh man, this lake froze or this lake froze. Now I want to go after the burbot or go after the, you know, the trout or something like that. So sometimes hunting is my favorite, but every once in a while I'll go.
There's a change almost within seasons where he's like, yeah, I could start going after this now. Like James already even started talking about turkeys.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Do you guys do a lot of turkey hunting out there?
Yeah, we do. I'm planning on it. I have an area that I like to go down by the river that's that's produced well. So yeah, okay. I'm looking forward to that too. I forgot.
Yeah,
turkey season.
You always got something on the horizon. You know, our next hunt, and this is kind of new for us, but we've started doing some small game hunting and with our bows, and we decided why don't we do a small game camp? So we're headed up to northern Michigan. We got our heated teepee, and we're gonna go backcountry small game hunt for grouse and
the RK1s.
Yeah, with the we shoot recurve. So
ooh.
So it's going to be old traditional up north flannel wearing good time. Hopefully we get some bunnies. I got a great barbecue, smoked squirrel barbecue recipe that I've been really working up in my head. So
sounds delicious.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about it.
I was going to say, you're going to snowshoe in?
Well, you never know. Maybe. Hopefully we don't have to. You never know what the weather is going to be like there. It's been warm around here lately, but it's starting to get cold. Like last year we went up, we did a late season deer hunt, and it was like 2.5 feet of snow, which was a blast. But this year it was nothing. Like it was pretty bone dry. So we got a lot of snow in November, and then it all went away. But yeah, small game is our thing. And then Jared, we really do have to get into the, start doing some ice fishing again, because we kind of let that one slip.
I know. Sid kind of touched on something I really want to get back into.
Yeah. But we're so bad at it. Yeah. You know, like, I don't have any of the gear. When I grew up, my, you know, like you mentioned, your grandpa and your dad and your uncles, they all show you what to do. We did a lot of small game, a lot of deer hunting and like bass fishing and crappie mm-hmm. fishing. Nice. But no one really ever taught me how to find fish in the ice. So I've gone a bunch.
Fish finder, man.
Yeah.
Is that just dump them in there. Unless Sid, you got a way that you guys like to do it.
I think the best way is to know, like, where when we go try to ice fish a lake, either you talk to people.
Yeah.
You know, if you never fished a lake, sometimes you look at holes to see if there's like blood or something around the holes that helped. The best way is to typically like know their beds. So where they were in the springtime, summertime.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
And then, and do it that way. But sometimes it's just trial and error. You just got to move around till you feel luck, feel that luck.
What type of days will you get your best fishing activity on? Are you talking like a bright, shiny day, or you get do better luck with it when it's like cloudy out?
The best days are, you know, I some people think it's not true, but I really think moon plays a big role.
You're not the first person to say that.
Yeah, I think it does. I've noticed like if the moon's going to be out, then you want to try to get that like early, like fish early, like at 6 before it gets light, which is like 7:40.
Yeah.
But the best day is when there's no moon. Usually it's like early ice, so like December. And, you know, you just kill it. You start like at 7 and you can't get them off your hook till like 11. So
are you going after gills or what? What are you going after?
I like trout the best. There's a few lakes around where I'm at that have some bluegills, but I like trout the best mainly because my wife, and it's weird because she doesn't like fish, but she likes trout. And I think because she grew up on it, but she says, if you're going to go, I'd rather you kill couch trout because then we can eat it. So I get the pass to go ice fishing if I bring home trout.
Because you're providing.
I don't bring home. Yeah, I'm providing. So when I go to a lake around here that has bass or bluegills or perch, she doesn't like that. She's like, "Well, I don't want to eat that, so you can't go." I'm like, "Ah."
She's got you there.
All right, I guess I'm going trout fishing, man.
How are you cooking those bad boys up?
My kids like to deep. We like to deep fry them. We like to bread them. The way that I take that second rib cage out, it takes a little bit more work. That's the way my family likes to eat them. I personally like to just put them in the smoker or like a brine and then smoke them that way and then just kind of snack on them throughout the day or turn into a dip. But smoking or frying them. So
I guess I bought it from you. I just bought Jared's smoker.
My smoker.
And I've smoked pretty much everything I've eaten in the past couple weeks has been smoked. So I went a little overboard with it. But it's like a new toy that I just want to keep, you know, trying out.
You have to. I think when we first bought our smoker, we didn't use our oven for like a year.
So. That's right. Yeah. And then I always take the bones and I'll make broth with the bones from whatever I make. Broth now is smoky. So it's got that smoky flavor.
Do you can your stock? Your both?
I freeze it.
Okay.
And then I'll just, actually, I drink it.
You do.
It's really so good weird. For you. I'm, I mean, it's good for your gut. It's like hot chocolate. Yeah. Something like that.
Yeah.
It's a mountain man's hot chocolate.
It's bone chocolate.
That's right. Before we move on in this conversation, we're going to take a quick second to introduce a new segment called Mastering Glass with Sturka Optics, where we bring on Josh, the product manager from Sturka, to answer a few quick questions about glassing. These are all questions that we get on our social media page, so if you have some, shoot us a message and we'll make sure to get him answering those questions. What's the best way to take pictures through your optics?
There's a lot of different things that you can do to take pictures through your optics, whether it be binoculars or spotting scopes. There are a lot of aftermarket items that you can, like, for example, bone scope is a great one where it mounts easily. You can easily mount it to your binoculars or your spotting scope. There's also some cell phone adapters out there that you can use. You can try to handhold, but it is best to have something that is actually securing both the phone or the camera and securing it securely to the optic itself so you're actually centered properly and actually get a better image.
And that was Mastering Glass with Sturka. Now back to our talk. So you have any big hunts planned for 2019, now that it is 2019?
You know, no, I don't. When I talked to my coach, I says, you know, with this Ironman coming, you know, I understand that, you know, I hope you understand that I do like to hunt. This is my number one goal to do this. And the hunts fall during the times where I'll be at my, almost at my peak distances, where I'll be training, you know, 20 or so, you know, hours a week.
Right.
And so there will be time for hunting, and he agrees that it's going to be a great time to try to bring all that in and maybe use hiking as like a training tool. Yeah. But right now I just have general tags. So I'll more than likely have a deer tag and an elk tag here in Utah.
Okay.
But yeah, no, the horizon's still there. Texas has always been something that I did this year, and I hope to do it again next year. So we'll see.
Are you doing whitetail heavily?
Yeah. Yeah. My first whitetail I harvested, this year, or excuse me, 2018. And it was a hoot. I had so much fun.
Were you sitting doing the typical blind sit, you know, ambush hunting?
We did a little bit of the sitting in a blind, because it was Southern Texas. We didn't really have, in the desert, we didn't have the big trees. But yeah, it ended up where we had located him, where he was chasing does, and then we put an ambush on him. But
nice.
It's so totally different. Like the white, I've been hunting mule deer all my life, and just the white tail are like, I was amazed on how small they were, because I had them at 60 yards, and I feel comfortable at 60 yards for a mule deer or an elk. But for a whitetail, when I drew back, I was like, oh my gosh, that feels like it's farther than 60. And well, that's because he's half the size.
Oh, so, yeah. Mm-hmm. Especially those southern deer. I mean, those things are tiny. They have giant racks, but they are small.
Nice wide, skinny racks. But
yeah.
Yes. Yes, they were. He was tiny. So finally, I didn't want to take the chance. So we waited till I got within 41 of when I released the arrow. So, it was fun. Like they're just smaller. They definitely are a little more wiry than what I'm used to. So,
yeah,
wiry. How so?
The doe was just like when I've seen animals knowing that they're being hunted, from mule deer, it seems like they almost kind of give you that second opportunity a little bit. Whitetail is like, as soon as they feel like there's pressure or something, I mean, they don't even give you a second chance. They just go on.
We know that. That's the story of our life. We mostly deer whitetail hunt, so it's like you get maybe a chance, and sometimes I feel like I don't even know if they really see me or hear me or smell me, and they're gone anyways.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, like, is there ever a time where a deer's in the woods and no one's around and it just runs away because it thinks someone's around? I'm sure that happens.
It's like saying when a tree falls in the woods, if no one's around, doesn't
make sense. That's how deep I am. And especially when I'm in the woods, I'm having some deep thoughts out there, man.
Maybe.
Some metaphysical stuff.
That or they're just, you know, they're saw, you know, maybe a nightmare of some sort.
But that's right.
To me, it looked like they were on meth, or they're just twitching, you know, they're just, you know, can't figure out what to do. And then just out of nowhere, I'm like, cause the same thing, I was like, there's no way she would have smelled me, or she didn't see me, but she just decided to, I mean, the buck, you know, he was as dumb as they get, but the doe, a night that was just totally different from what I'm used to.
So now coming this elk season, you're going to be in top shape. I'm going to imagine you're going to be going deep into the backcountry for elk.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, hauling a lot of weight on your back, because you're going to be like in amazing shape. Is that right?
Yep. Yeah. I've already have a couple areas that I'm ready to get into before I felt like I could hike in there, but I couldn't bring an elk out because it'd be at least, you know, 4 or 5 trips by myself, but this time around I feel confident that I could get him out. So yeah, I'm looking forward to it, because I don't think anybody killed this 6-point that I've seen in there, and so I'm hoping to get back in there if he's still there.
Now when you're hiking back, I mean, on prosthetics, is that hard with the uneven terrain? Does that give you trouble, or is that kind of just the same amount of trouble it might give anybody?
No, it's more probably because my prosthetic, that where that spring is, there's no mass, and so I'm more top heavy, so I can't, and I'm not feeling the ground is like you would with your feet and your ankles as it tries to position that center of gravity. For me, I have to use my knees and my hips, and I'm already using my knees and quads and hips to push, and so now to use those as, you know, more of a stability thing, fatigue a little bit faster. So I use things like trekking poles that help with my balance. You know, I fall over regardless, but having good balance allows me to hike further because I'm not so fatigued trying to stabilize my body.
How big are like the platforms of these? Like the part you're actually making contact with the ground, like how incomparable, like how big is that?
It's in a foot shell, and then that foot shell's based on the arc. So it's like I wear a size 12 shoe.
Okay.
Now the running prosthetics I use for running doesn't have that. It's about the size of a deck of cards. So when I'm running,
that's the one I'm thinking of.
Okay.
Yeah. And those are definitely not something I would hike with, let alone trail run. If I had a sound leg, like a meat leg, I guess you want to call it, then I would probably trail run with one of those blades. But as a double, it's hard to even stand. In fact, people think I have to go to the bathroom because I do the party dance trying to balance.
So you take your kids out hunting with you a lot?
Yes. Yeah. In fact, my son, for the first time, he's nine now. We chased this bull that got within 30 yards and we was in some thick trees. I could not get a shot off.
Oh man.
But he was bugling right there enough to I think he grew chest hair. I think it was that intense. And he was like, it was so cool to look at his face and his eyes get big. And he knew something big was going to happen. And the bull, I think, just kind of circled us and winded us. But he thought that was the coolest thing. And then towards the end of the hunt, I was helping guiding my brother-in-law. And he had killed his first elk, and my son was right there to see the whole animal come in, get shot, go down, clean it, you know, take it apart. And so to see that whole experience was cool. So he thought that was awesome.
Yeah, he did well with the butchering and everything too.
Yeah, yeah, you know, I bring him into the garage normally, and so he's seen me skin it and quarter it and then put it through the processor, grinder, and then vacuum seal it. So he knows where meat comes from.
Yeah, that's cool.
You know, my daughters, on the other hand, they're like, ew, and they go inside.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely like an exposure thing, I think. You know, like the earlier exposed, it's like not even a big deal. Mm-hmm. And if I think boys too. I think that's how that goes. Although my daughter, I take her out. She's all about the butchering and the heart and everything else. So
Nice cut, Dad.
Yeah, she's always cheering me on, watching me butcher in the garage. No, that's cool. I mean, I can't even imagine being, 9 years old, watching a bugling elk come in. That's how I should get chest hair. I should see a bugling elk. Maybe I'll get some. I'm sprout a few.
Is that how we're going to do it?
Because I'm not very hairy. Yeah.
Yeah, that's probably where it comes from. Maybe I've seen a lot of elk because my wife seems like I said I need to shave. So
yeah, well, that'll happen.
You leave bare chest to come back with a
come
rug.
Back a man well, every honey, year. Yeah, I'm
coming back bugling all over.
That's right. So do you bugle a lot out there? Are you more of a silent sneaker upper?
No, I do like to bugle in certain areas. So where I hunt is an open bull unit. And it's a lot of the elk focus in this area. And so you get everybody from all over the state.
Sure.
It's kind of a pet peeve of mine that the state doesn't separate the over the counter units a little bit better, but that's for another discussion. But anyway, they'll come over here and it's like even the archery hunt, they just get called all the time. So where I will bugle a lot more is in areas that there's not a lot of calling. Where it's a little harder to get into, or it's access areas that people don't know about. So I'll bugle a lot there.
Yeah.
But if it's in a highly populated area where I know there's elk, I may not even cow call because there's so many people calling anyways that I can figure it out typically what's going on.
Can you differentiate a human caller from an elk?
Yeah, pretty good. There was a guy last year and it was super embarrassing that I snuck in and I'm like, oh crap. And
so like, are there just some terrible callers? Like you just know like, oh my gosh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, oh, I didn't know someone's cat's dying or something because it sounds horrible. But, and there's a diaphragm call. I feel like you can just get a lot more character and sounds a lot better, especially if you're using like a big grunt tube. But like there's some of those blue reed stuff, or there's like a little, you know, vacuum hose type thing, and you can just tell because it's the same sound. And so it's like, well, yeah, I know who that is. So.
But you were tricked this past year, it sounds like. So some guys are
A couple of years ago, I did sneak in thinking that it was an elk. And I think it's the ultimate compliment if someone comes in on your call.
Did you let them know, hey, man, you did a heck of a job just now. You called me right in.
No, because he was in the tree stand. But I did give him a shot with a thumbs up. I'm like, good job. Nice. Dude.
You got to give a guy his props. You did it, man. He earned that.
You did it.
Yeah.
You know what? Maybe there'll be a time for a different story. But James's turkey calling ability is some of the worst I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah, it is. I'm not even going to argue with it. I
unbelievably bad. You want to talk about
I use the
dying.
Slate call now. Or not the slate. I use the box call, like the children's
it's
call.
Improved, but your diaphragm skills, but my, no, Joe would not be proud.
I know. Joe would be very disappointed if he heard me with a diaphragm call. Although I've kept mine. I've been practicing it. I've actually been practicing my elk bugle. Although I guarantee when we go out bow hunting this year for elk, I won't be touching that. I probably won't even bring it with.
No, you're just going to go sneaky.
Where are you guys going to go?
We're talking about a couple places in Colorado, just because I've been there. But we don't have anything really set in stone yet. We're just looking. So, you know, it's a lot of
we're getting there,
especially coming from the East. You know, you're trying to figure out units and draw sight us, you know, how that all works. It's very foreign to us. So, you know, I'm a couple years in and it's still something that it's still kind of a struggle to figure out new states. And part of it's like, well, we're used to Colorado. Yep. So maybe we just do that. I had a friend who did Utah last year, saw some, didn't have a shot. Kyle? Yeah, mm-hmm. Kyle. So
it was bow.
I went twice with rifle. I was second rifle season for Colorado, which is just like everybody and their brother is out there, and that's all. I knew it going in. You know, you're not going to see very many elk. Most of them got blown out into lower and private land, but that's why I want to go early, take the bow. I like to bow hunt more anyways.
Jimmy needs to redeem himself.
I do,
after 2 years of being skunked.
I found this year, I did find a deadhead that was from a bow season. So I found some dude's elk. But that's about it.
Nice.
I didn't even claim it for myself. I should have done that.
What a good
should
guy.
Have told everybody, look what I shot.
Nice.
It was half gnawed by like a squirrel out there.
I already started chewing on it.
Yeah, that's right. The porcupines went to town, but yeah.
No, you picked a good state. I mean, I'm 30 miles away from the border of Colorado. And
okay.
I mean, they do well as far as managing their herds. They do issue a lot of tags, but
yeah.
I think you did good as far as if you were an out-of-stater and you want to get that elk experience.
Yeah,
especially with a bow.
Oh yeah, it's gonna be a blast. We'll go out for a couple of days. How many days do you typically backcountry hunt? You out there for a weekend, week? What do you do?
It just depends. Like, if it's a specific animal, and I'm gonna like, I'll try to because of PTO and what days I can have off.
Yeah.
If I find an animal that I really want to go after, whether it be elk or deer, I'll focus on taking, you know, a day before or more,
right,
just to get prepared. But I like to spend anywhere from like 3 to 4 nights. And then, then like for me, I bought the multi-season elk tag. So just depends. So like for during the peak rut time, I'll spend more time because I know I have a better chance that way. Or if it's something I just have a weekend there, then I'll do a weekend here and there. But I like to invest a good amount of time altogether, probably 10 days.
Okay.
Do you feel like with the 3 to 4 nights, you're able to get the places like that you want to go? Or you feel like after those 3 or 4 days, you're just starting to figure things out?
No, because of the scouting that I could do prior.
Right. Mm.
But if I was to hunt like Colorado or Idaho or Wyoming, which I've been putting into, it might be different where I would probably want more time just because I would spend a couple of days just trying to figure out or even to get an idea of what the animals are doing. But okay. For Utah, where I hunt, I kind of have a general idea where, you know, what happens when there's pressure, where's the water, and
right,
so forth.
Sure. When you're back there, what's your What's one thing you bring back that's kind of like a comforting thing that maybe not everybody brings? Like Jared brings his blankie out there.
I haven't even been out yet.
That's true. I'm making all that up.
Yeah.
What do you bring out?
Oh, that's kind of like that most people don't bring that maybe that, something I bring.
Yeah. That luxury item.
Yeah.
Oh, the luxury item.
Yes. Yeah. Just something nice. Something you treat item. Yourself with.
Treat yourself.
I don't know what they're called without being racist. I call them Mexican bats, but I don't know what the name of it
Mexican
is.
Mexican bats?
Mexican bats.
Is it like a wet like wipe?
It's like a giant, but it's not wet wipe. It's like a towel, but I don't know the name of it. Sorry.
Not a bad call.
Yeah.
But I like to take a bath and then back door out or back country every once in a while.
Being clean, man. You get that like greasy feeling.
The old undercarriage needs a little bath sometimes.
That's right. Yeah.
No. Do you cut it up and like, can you reuse it or is it like a one time
deal? No. One time deal.
Man, so you got to really wait for that one time.
Yeah. But I'd say the luxury side of it is some guys will go every 3 days or every 4 days before they start trying to clean up. I'm like every other day.
Yeah, you got to stay fresh, man.
Well, yeah. Especially with my stumps, because if it gets sweaty and they get itchy and sometimes they get like bacteria and stuff like that, then it hurts to walk. So
that's understandable.
I got a good one for this. Okay. This year in Colorado, I was leaving and my 6-year-old daughter came up to me and goes, "Hey, Dad, I need you to take this. This is yours now." She hands me a little pink bunny. And so I brought this bunny everywhere when I was hunting. I threw it in my pack and it was just a small little stuffed bunny that she gave me. And so I took pictures of it using my binoculars and I was sending it to him. I took pictures of it, you know, by the campfire. I had one time this year where my boots sprung a leak somewhere at some point and it got really cold. Got some black toe action going on. And so there's a picture of me just like suffering with cold feet, fire. And then my wife calls him Smudge or Smug because of how smug I am with when I have it because she didn't give it to my wife, but with me and Smudge out there. So that was my comfort item that I brought this year. It was pretty nice. It was like you hug it at night, you know.
All right.
Not a bad call.
Not a bad call, right?
Oh, that's good.
It's
good to remember that.
We're coming up on time here. We don't want to take too much of your night, but there's a question that, and maybe this is the maybe this will be the last time I ask this question because we've been asking guests this question for a while.
You're gonna get, and you're gonna retire
2019,
the question.
Well, it's 2019, and maybe I got to think of a new one. When you're out in the backcountry, Sid, and you open your backpack and you're looking at what's in there, is there anything ever? What's the most useless item that you bring, or something that you know? You maybe pack and you maybe regret, but it's always in your backpack and you leave it in.
Like, I never once used this toothbrush.
Yeah.
Which,
I haven't brushed my teeth in 3 days and no one said a thing.
You know what? It's got to be clothes. Like, I get worried, like, oh man, I'm going to be so cold. I need to bring this extra coat. Or it's like, oh, I need this extra, you know, insulation. So I tend to bring probably a few extra clothes than I need to bring.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I bring lots of probably too much food, like not like meals, but like snacks. So like goo gels and nut butters. And I when I get off the mountain, I was like, man, that's like a whole bunch right there. I get a little worried that my prosthetic stuff's going to break. So I bring like tool kits and Allen wrenches and glue and different alcohol that cleans different valves and stuff like that. And I ended up being so much crap, but I've never once used it, knock on wood. So hopefully
you've not had a breakdown at all back there.
The one time I was kind of, and it wasn't even in the backcountry, it was at the Total Archery Challenge at Snowbird.
Oh yeah.
I was coming off the mountain. We were shooting with like Corey Jacobson and Donnie Drake and those guys. I was with Donnie and my buddy Mike, and like all of a sudden I felt like a rattle in my leg and a bolt was coming loose that attached the ankle to the socket. And it just sucked because it needed an Allen wrench. We're like, well, we're out in the mountain. Everybody has Allen
wrenches. It's archery. Yeah. A bunch of archers.
But it was, I needed metric, and everybody had standard.
Yeah,
everybody had standard. Yeah. I'm like, oh, you're kidding me! And it, you couldn't just make it work. It had to be tight and super tight, and a metric would just slide around in there and strip. Yeah.
I've stripped many things using the wrong, wrong one.
Yeah, so it sucked. So it's like the whole time while I was doing the shoot, I had to constantly try to finger tighten or use a standard Allen wrench to kind of tighten it, and then like
it's not the
within 100 yards of walking, it comes loose again. Oh, it was a pain.
So you like those tack, those shoots?
Oh yeah, they are so fun.
Those are awesome.
The terrain's pretty intense, especially at Snowbird. No, it's a lot of fun. It's you lose a lot of arrows, but it's fun.
Can we take our recurves or anything?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. There's lots of guys, that do
guys
that.
Out there. Oh yeah, 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 yeah. We got one out in Boyne Mountain, Michigan, up north, on some ski hills and stuff, because we don't have any mountains around here, and it's a lot of fun. A lot of people go.
Mm-hmm.
Good.
But it is a great way to lose an arrow. All right, Sid. Well, thanks so much for taking the time out of your schedule. Appreciate talking to you. You sharing your story. Just you're a really inspirational guy, and we're thankful to have you.
Oh, thanks, guys. I appreciate the opportunity, and enjoyed talking to you guys.
Awesome.
All right. Well, have a good one. We'll talk to you soon.